Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt and Scott Keith, and we have a special guest today, Pastor Donovan Riley. A lot of listeners will probably recognize Donovan. He's on a lot of blogs online. He writes regularly for the 1517 Legacy blog for Higher Things. He's also one of the co-hosts on the Higher Things podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, the simulcast.
So you have a, I would say, a far-reaching online presence in the Luther world.
We're betting on it, as a matter of fact.
It's a small world.
Yeah, so we're going to make sure that he shares this show within all those outlets, or he's not welcome back. No, just kidding.
That's understandable. But I shot your gun, smoked your pipe, and drank your coffee, so I'm going to go home.
We don't own guns.
Yeah, no.
That's we must have rented at the rain.
We're off the rails. We haven't even started yet.
Okay.
But to get into today, we are still doing our series on great thinkers of the Christian faith. And today we're going to do probably what Lutherans would consider the capstone of this series. We're going to talk about Martin Luther, but there's a twist. We've decided as of today, we're going to try to talk about Luther a couple of times.
Well, this is Donovan and I were talking today, and this is sort of what I've landed on, is that we have the potential to have some wonderful Luther scholars on the show, and I don't want to miss the opportunity to give us what they know and to share that with us. I mean, after all, the show goes out, I hope, to all sorts of people, but the hosts are Lutheran, right? And so our heritage is really based on the Reformation that was first started by Luther. And then there's certainly several of his colleagues helped along the way, but Luther was really the backbone of this thing. And so when we have the opportunity for a great Luther scholar to come on and talk about Luther, I think we're going to take advantage of that and bring them on. Hopefully we'll have the chance to have Jim Nestigan on again. Steve Paulson is coming out to speak at the Here We Still Stand conference. I intend for us to interview him, and believe it or not, I'm going to ask him to talk about Luther. And so that's the deal. Donovan, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get going, and then I'll sort of maybe draw in some of our common links and why it's important that you talk about Luther today.
Sure. Long story short, I grew up atheist. I was raised atheist and came to the Christian faith in my mid-20s, early mid-20s. And after kind of wandering through different groups within the church, born-again Christians, evangelicals, charismatics, non-denominationals, West Coast, Vineyard, Foursquare groups, I kind of by accident through a friend ended up attending a Lutheran church. And the pastor and I struck up a relationship, and he introduced me to the catechism and some of Luther's works. And from reading the catechism, I fell in love with Luther when I read the catechism. And then reading other works like his Romans commentary, Freedom of the Christian Man, things like that, I really fell in love with Luther, and I decided almost immediately upon reading Luther that I'd follow him wherever he wanted me to go, and whatever he wanted to teach me, I was open to it. And so I became a Lutheran, joined the Lutheran Church, LCMS, and then that kind of started my whole love affair with Luther. And I went back to school, got another bachelor's degree so I could go and get my MDiv, and then from the MDiv decided I didn't want to be a pastor. And so I went on to get my PhD in church history and wrote my dissertation on Luther, and specifically on the theology of the cross and what that meant for Luther. And the consequences for Luther down the road, you know, with his further works after Heidelberg in 1518, which is kind of where he hatched that term and explained it. And then after running away from ministry for 10 years, I became a pastor because God emptied me of resources and time and forced me to make a decision. And that was the corner that he forced me into. So I've been a pastor now for 9 years at St. John's Evangelical Lutheran, LCMS, in Webster, Minnesota, as their pastor. And you know, do all kinds of other stuff online and in person in the lack of free time that I actually have.
And have quite a few resources hidden in your basement, apparently.
I do have quite a few resources hidden away here and there.
Yeah, so when you were doing your doctoral work, you studied, in part at least, with Jim Nestigan.
Yeah.
Who was my thesis supervisor on my PhD as well. So we have that connection. I didn't know that when we first met. It was interesting.
That's right.
It's been interesting to find that out sort of along the way. Hopefully, at some point, like I said, we'll get Jim Nestigan back on the show and have him talk about Luther, too. what I thought might be fun today, Donovan, is you, if maybe you could just sort of work us through Luther, sort of maybe not early life, but if you want to, a little bit of that, if you can do that. If not, just sort of how he came to back really to the faith and to service as a monk, and then his quote-unquote evangelical conversion through that. And then it might be fun, I think, to sort of focus on the development of the theology of the cross versus theology of glory, because I think many people would say that's central to understanding Luther's theology.
Right.
And in point of fact, I don't think that most people understand it. So
no, I think that's a good point.
I think it would be good for us to cover it a bit.
I think, you know, and it's an interesting tribe of people who came through a certain vein within the Lutheran tradition, through guys like Jim Nestegen and Jim Kittelsen, and even probably or maybe lesser known Luther scholars like Heiko Olbermann, Carter Lindberg, Wilhelm Pauk, going back through Hermann Saze in the early 20th century and so on, there's a particular vein, like I said, a tradition within Lutheranism, and I think it just draws a certain kind of person, a certain kind of personality that is attracted to Luther. And there's a kind of, I think, kindred spirit when you read Luther, at least it was for me, especially as an adult convert. Luther, when I read the Small Catechism and I read the third article of the Creed, I believe I cannot, by my own reason or understanding, believe in Jesus, or reason or strength, believe in Jesus Christ, my Lord, or come to him. But the Holy Spirit called me by the gospel. For me as an adult convert, that was the first thing I'd ever read by any Christian that spoke to me specifically as an adult convert. And that's really what caused me to fall in love with Luther and follow him as my teacher. And then through meeting people like Jim Kittelsen, who was a great Luther scholar, wrote a great book on Luther the Reformer that I still use to this day as a pastor. And guys like Jim Nestegen and other historians like Heiko and Carter, Hans Hillebrand. What I discovered then is that my love affair with Luther wasn't, you know, just random. It wasn't just because I had read something that really piqued me anecdotally. It was that Luther himself had gone through very similar circumstances growing up in what was really the collapse of feudalism. Because if you understand, Luther was born right at the cusp of Columbus, for example, sailing the Ocean Blue in 1492, and the advent of the printing press in around the same time. And with all of that, the collapse of feudalism, the collapse of a lot of late medieval institutions was happening while he was growing up. And so his father, Hans, was what we would consider a part of kind of a new middle class that was happening, it was growing. And he started working in a mine, then he bought a mine, then he bought several mines. And
copper, right?
Copper. And what Hans and Luther's mom wanted most for their son, as any upwardly mobile white middle-class couple wants for their child, is that the child has a better life than they do.
Right. Better education, better money, better circumstances.
And at that time, there were basically three vocations that were looked upon as being praiseworthy: lawyer, doctor, and theologian.
Right.
And so Hans sunk a lot of money into Luther's education so that he could be a lawyer. Bought him books, sent him to, you know, the best schools that he could afford. And it seemed, you know, for all intents and purposes, that was the track that Luther would be on. He wasn't, you know, a lot of people probably think he was a genius and he was an exceptional student and he stood out, and he wasn't, at least not early on.
Right.
Right. He was a middling student. And, you know, he didn't do bad. He just didn't do great. And later in life, he complained about how much he hated school and he didn't like his teachers. And that certainly contributed to it. But, you know, once he got to that point where he was going to go on and study for his exams to take the bar to become a lawyer, there's different stories about what happened to Luther. Even Luther himself gives
told story
stories
at least two or three different ways.
Yeah. But I think the one that's the most plausible, and the one that other Luther scholars find the most plausible, is that they were out, he and a friend were out, and at that time it was a custom, it was a fashion that students wore a ceremonial dagger on their hip. And Luther fell and stabbed himself in the thigh with his dagger and was bleeding out. And so his friend propped him up against a tree with his legs up in the air and went back to get help. Now, on another occasion, Luther was caught in this huge storm where he cries out to St. Anne, the famous story of St. Anne.
Save me and I'll become a monk.
Right. And those are two different stories. And yet, if you look at the history there, you look at not only Luther and what he says, but people like Justice Jonas and Veit Dietrich and, you know, kind of the secretaries of Luther who recorded a lot of things, not just from Luther himself, but from other sources. It was a series of events that pushed Luther to go to the Augustinian monastery and knock on the door and say, I want to become a monk. And he threw a big party for all of his friends at the bar.
Gave away his books.
Gave away his books, gave away everything and said, see you boys, I'm going to be a monk.
In the story that he cries out to St. Anne, that's, I've heard some scholars say that he could have made that up because St. Anne was the patron saint of miners, right?
Yes.
And that it would have been an interesting appeal to his father, the owner of mines, to say, well, Father, I made a pledge to St. Anne.
Right.
Yeah. I have to do this.
Right.
Wow. Yeah.
Very interesting.
And, I think that's, for the most part, that's conjecture, but it's interesting.
Well, it's not as if Luther wasn't given to embellishment.
Right.
Often. or he wasn't
shocked.
Grandiose.
Shocked.
But, no, and so, you know, he went through the year-long kind of probationary period, that's how we would think of it, you know, that they wanted to make sure that you were serious about becoming a monk, and so you had to go through a year-long kind of initiation, and he became a monk, and he went through his training, and that's when his superiors started to notice that there was something exceptional about Luther in relation to theological thinking, and his curiosity and his hunger for knowledge in relation to the Bible.
And his dedication to a fault.
Yeah, you know, that again, he whatever led Luther to join the monastery, in the end, whether it was a series of events or one cataclysmic event, a series of events led him to make a drastic decision to change his life, the course of his life, his vocation. And it meant, you know, cutting himself off from his family. It meant alienating his father and his mother, angering his father especially. And it was, and leaving his friends, leaving his security, leaving the comfort of what he'd known since he was a little boy, since he was 5 or 6 years old. So it wasn't something that he just did on the spur of the moment, or it was like a dare or something like that. It was something that he was very serious about. And again, I think there's a certain amount of Pauline envy in Luther when he talks about being a monk too, that I was a monk of monks. Mm-hmm. Paul says I was a Pharisee amongst Pharisees. Right. And yet, according to Staupitz and other people who were there, he really was that devout. Yeah. He would starve. You know, we know this because later in life, a lot of Luther's physical ailments were a direct result of what he did to himself.
Attributed to the different times he prostrates himself.
Yeah, he would whip himself, flagellate himself. He would sit outside in the snow in nothing but a loincloth and pray and fast. And, and you know, ultimately, it's still, I think, a trajectory, not just the entering the monastery, but just the time in the monastery. He's constantly asking why. He's constantly driving, because he's got that question, how do I find a merciful God? How do I find a God that's faithful, loving, and kind, that will say, I forgive you unconditionally? And without going too blue, later in life, Luther points out that one of the things that drove him to despair was that he beat his body, he prayed, he fasted, he went to confession. He did everything that a monk was expected to do and more, and disciplined his body daily. And yet every night he would go to sleep and he would have sexual dreams. And then he would wake up in the morning and he'd soiled himself. And he despaired because he said, how can I control my thoughts and my body when I'm not even awake, I'm not even conscious? And that ultimately also drove him to despair of himself and ask, you know, the late medieval teaching was, do what is in you, facere quodins est. And Luther grew up with that, and he embodied it. He tried to manifest it as much as he could as a monk. But how can you do what is in you when you're asleep and you're not even conscious of your own actions? Mm-hmm. What do you do then? You can't control yourself. And that really drove him to despair, like I said. And that drove him deeper into the Bible. It drove him to ask more questions of his father confessor. And, you know, I think it was Staupitz who actually made the remark that when he'd see Luther coming, he would hide.
He'd hide.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have time for this.
Yeah, I don't have time to hear your confession.
I had heard that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like asking.
Yells at him for coming back right after he left.
Right. Yeah. He's like, oh, I forgot a sin.
Yeah. Enough.
And, so it's like, you know, all the religions are the same, Martin. Have you considered another monastery possibly?
Right. Yeah.
But but they recognized that he had these gifts, and they were the ones who pushed him to get his theology degree. And
one of the dumbest decisions in the history of the Roman Church.
Right, yeah. Is there any way we can get rid of him? I know. Let's make him a professor.
I'm really smart.
And so he did. He excelled at it. He passed his exams, and I think he received his doctorate in 1505, was it, initially, 1505? I can't remember off the top of my head exactly, but it was around 1505, because I just remember that was the first time that Luther talks about he bought one of the first Hebrew lexicons, was published in 1505.
1512, he was awarded the Doctor of Theology.
There it is, yeah, because he started lecturing soon after that in the Psalms. And so you come out the other side of that 1513, he's sent to a backwater, Ely, Minnesota kind of.
And I think people don't realize that, but when you read the histories of the Reformation and the perception even of some of the high scholars of the time of the University of Wittenberg,
right,
it's very low. I mean, it's this place probably not even accredited.
Do you know what Wittenberg was famous for?
No.
Prostitutes, fish, and beer.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that's
pigs,
why they had. That's why they had the bishops' conference there every year.
Wow.
Yeah. No, the birth rate went way up every 9 months after the bishops' conference.
Oh, gosh. As Luther said, you couldn't in that time you couldn't cross the street in Wittenberg without tripping over a syphilitic monk.
Exactly.
Oh.
Yeah. And the streets were mud, and there was a pig farmer on every corner, and Frederick decided, no, we're gonna elevate.
We're going to classes join up.
Gentrification.
Yeah. And so Luther was sent there, of all places, which, like I said, is like being sent to, you know, I'm from the Midwest. It's like being sent to Ely, Minnesota, up in the northeastern tip of Minnesota to go to college and go, it's like Notre Dame or Harvard or Oxford. it's just a little bit more out of the way to go to Vermilion Community College. Nobody went to Wittenberg on purpose in those days. And it was a new university. And that's why, you know, you can speak to this too. That's why Melanchthon was hired there, because no one else would hire Melanchthon because he was too young. He was a 17-year-old punk.
Right.
And they said, we'll take him at Wittenberg.
Haughty at that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so Luther starts his lectures, and you can already see in the first Psalms lectures that he's wrestling with Augustine. He's wrestling with late medieval theology. He's wrestling with people like Ockham and others. And by the end of those lectures, he's got a hold of justification. And
by the end of the Psalms lectures?
Yes, he's got a hold of it. It's just he's so steeped in this late medieval theological tradition that I don't think his piety allows him at that time to break loose of that. Plus, you have to remember at that time, what he is saying to his students is still shocking. And he's a brand new professor. And he himself is not sure. He's working through these things while he's lecturing.
Right. And he's still not proficient in Hebrew.
Nope.
He's not proficient in Greek at
Correct.
This point. And so he knows that, I think. He's struggling through the Latin. I think he's using whatever tools he can to get a handle on the context from the Hebrew and Greek.
Right.
But not there. He doesn't really get a solid handle on Greek until after 1519, 1520, when Melanchthon's
there,
to Wittenberg and starts teaching him.
Well, I don't think a lot of people who aren't familiar with the history realize that a lot of the Latin Bibles, the Vulgate Bibles, were kind of a cut and paste, if you had one. The Greek translation that Erasmus publishes, where there were
the critical edition.
The critical edition was actually him pasting the Vulgate in where there was no Greek text to translate.
Yeah.
And so it was a mess of a translation, and Luther goes after him quite a bit in the 1520s for that.
But he used it.
Though he uses it. But it's what was available.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the largest library in Europe in the 1490s was in, like, Durham. It had 500 books. And I have 500 books on my phone. I mean, you know, the access to literature at that time was...
Developing.
Well, it was in a process of development. And Luther even talks about that, going to a monastery and seeing a Bible and, you know, so forth. But coming out of those early Psalms lectures in 1515 and going into the Romans lectures, I bring that up because for me, again, I followed Luther where he wanted me to go, and so I followed him into the Old Testament and into the Hebrew and the Hebrew translation into German because, for those who don't know, he was an Old Testament professor. If he worked in a modern faculty, he'd be an Old Testament prof. Luther comes to justification by faith alone through the Psalms, not Romans. He tunes it up in Romans, but the groundwork is already there in the Psalms. And I think the reason I say that's important is because we so often want to kind of characterize Luther as a New Testament theologian and say, well, the Romans, that's where justification is at. Not quite. Luther comes to this through the Psalms, through the Old Testament, and then hones that and sharpens that with Paul. Mm. And so by the time he gets to, there are so many people in church history who have written about Luther's Romans introduction, like John Bunyan, for example, and John Wesley, Charles Wesley, about reading that introduction or hearing that introduction to Romans read out loud and how it moved their heart to want to listen. Tyndale even talks about, the fact that Tyndale lived in Wittenberg for a while he was avoiding not being burned at the stake. But by the end of those Romans lectures, he's got it. He's got it. The problem is that nobody wants to listen to what he's got because it's very troubling. Even his colleagues are troubled by what he's saying about justification. And that's when things start to rumble, though, because that's, again, by that point, not only is he teaching, but he's also the principal, the superintendent of something like 11 or 12 monasteries. Right. And going through that, then he's becoming more public. Right. And his students are now going out and saying, this is what we're learning at Wittenberg.
Right.
So, and again, remember in those days.
And so they sent the synodical revision team to go check the theology at the department.
Right, because that's how it works.
Yeah.
No, there wasn't really that. It was more like it took 3 months to go one direction to tell somebody Luther is doing some stuff.
Yeah, 3 months to go back.
And 3 months to go back.
By the time they get back, he's doing something different. So they gotta send somebody back over there.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I always compare it that the 1512 to 15, let's say 21, is a lot like, if you can imagine the Beatles, right? Is that in 10 years, the Beatles went from She Loves Me, Yeah, 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 to Come Together. And performing on the rooftop of Apple Studios. And the same boy band that sings this four-part harmony, really poppy song, within 10 years produces Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road and these just radical, the redirection of music. They were learning and moving so quickly musically that year after year, they were changing their sound. Luther, very similarly, year after year in his lectures, is constantly in motion. And so by the time someone catches up to what he's saying, he's already on to the next thing. And the thing is, too, like Rod and I were talking about earlier, as a theologian, you sometimes think, well, I've got the gospel figured out. I know where the gospel's at. And then a theologian will come along and say, that's not the gospel. That's not where the gospel stops. That's just where you're afraid. That's just the line that you've drawn in the sand because you're afraid to go any further with the gospel. And Luther is constantly just erasing
that. Sounds like Nestigan right there without the brogue.
Oh. And so Luther is constantly moving the line. He's like, no, there's more gospel. There's more gospel. And his colleagues are saying, I don't know. That doesn't fit with what we were taught at seminary. That doesn't taught with how we're reading the scriptures. And so 1518 comes around, and this is really the benchmark. Is he's going to be relieved of his duties as superintendent of these monasteries at the annual meeting of the monks, the monastic order. And Luther,
he's an Augustinian, by the way.
Augustinian monk.
Right.
And every year they have debates, because that's what they would do, because they didn't have the internet. And so they had to get together to argue with each other.
No blogs?
No blogs. And Luther was also happened to be speaking that year and delivering these theses. And those are the Heidelberg theses. And everyone who heard them that day was either one way or the other had their mind lit up and their fuses blown. And so people like Martin Bucer came out of that, and he wrote letters home and said, I just heard the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, this is going to change everything. But then you had other guys writing to their cardinal or their bishop or Roman saying,
heretic.
This is the most heretical thing we've ever heard in our lives. Yeah. We got to shut this guy down.
Yeah.
And yet he's from Wittenberg. And so a lot of the higher ups who aren't aware of him or aren't aware of what he's been doing are saying, who, where?
Who? Why? Mm-hmm. Who cares?
Yeah, why do we care about this?
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember, most bishops at that time bought their
bishopric. Yeah,
it was just because mom and dad had some money and I want a fancy title. And so it wasn't as though
they had sort of gone through the paces, right?
It wasn't like theological reasons.
Went to train to be priests, trained to be doctors of theology, then went into bishops.
No, and again, the cardinals were, by and large, the College of Cardinals were corrupt.
Right.
And so it wasn't, theologically he's a problem. It was he's a threat to the general peace that we've established in the church and in society. And remember, at that time, the Roman Catholic Church owned 73% of all the land in Europe.
Right.
And you've got one guy up in Saxony causing trouble. And we just don't need that.
Right.
We just don't need that.
All right, we're going to take our break there, and then we'll pick this up when we get back. This is getting interesting. I want to hear the rest of the story. Donovan, I actually have to say, I haven't heard it told quite this way since I had a class with Jim Kittleson.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
I think it's good, too. It's pretty good. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, we'll take our break.
Welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a new radio show and podcast that is being produced and distributed by 1517 The Legacy Project. It's called You Are Forgiven Radio, and it's a collection of sermons, a particular type of sermon that I'm going to let Dr. Keith talk about.
You could actually let Donovan talk about it because he knows all about it.
Do I?
You sure do.
Am I supposed to be?
Yes. First Order Proclamation.
Yeah, oh, so First Order Proclamation.
So we've So 1517 has had certain pastors give us access to their sermons, and we've set them up with recording equipment, or you know, Faith already has it. But these pastors are known for good gospel-oriented preaching, and now we're gathering that together. We're editing it, and we have it on the radio in the greater LA area. So if you're in Southern California, it's on KKLA, which is 99.5, I want to say.
99.5. We're on Mondays at 3 a.m., Fridays at 3 a.m., and Sundays at 8 p.m.
Yes. So the idea is there is to catch people kind of when they're lonely and when they're looking for some...
Really coming out of the bars.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's be real.
But it's also available as a podcast on iTunes. So if you search You Are Forgiven Radio in iTunes or probably any other podcasting app, I just checked yesterday, it comes up as the first hit, and it's brand new. It's only a week old up on there. So if you want to hear some quite amazing sermons, that's a great resource to check out. We need ratings on iTunes to get that thing into the public eye. So the new noteworthy section on iTunes is dominated by, number one, being a new podcast, and number two, by having people give you a big wave of five-star reviews. So if listeners of the Thinking Fellows would go help that new project out, that would be fantastic. And then, yeah, maybe Scott and Donovan could talk about what First Order Proclamation is and why people need to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to make it simple, and then Donovan can chime in. Really, what we're doing is we're just going through as many sermons as we can from Pastor Paul Koch, Pastor Ron Hodel, Pastor Edward Killian, and Pastor Jeremy Rohde. And what we're looking for are First Order Proclamation. The best way I can say that are the sermons that talk about the died and risen again Jesus for you, mm-hmm. right? That there's a certain for you-ness in those sermons, that the gospel is for you, that it's not just that God so loved the world that he sent Christ to die and rise, but that God so loved you that he did these things, and that this forgiveness and this life, the salvation, this freedom from sin, death, and the power of the devil that was wrought by Christ through his death and resurrection is for you. Mm-hmm. That's for as easy as I could say it, First Order Proclamation. Now, Donovan can come clean it up.
No, I'd say that's good. You know, Second Order is descriptive. It's didactic. It's expository, which is fine in any sermon. You kind of have to do some exposition to set up the gospel text or whatever text you're preaching on. But that at some point in the sermon, if it's a Christian sermon, it has to move to First Order discourse. And the for you-ness of the gospel, the for you-ness of baptism, the for you-ness of the body and blood of Jesus is the force, it's the power of the gospel and the salvation. And without that move to First Order discourse, the for you-ness, that direct address, that declaration of justification, for example, like you said, you're left wondering, well, was that for me? Because I know that Jesus died for the sin of the world, but did he actually, you know, could he have really died for my sin? The for you-ness of the gospel addresses you specifically and says, yes, he died for your sin. And then secondly, where First Order Discourse takes on flesh, becomes fleshy, is as a pastor, when I'm preaching from the pulpit, there are still people who will say, I believe the gospel, I believe what you said, I just can't believe it's for me. And it'll fly over their head, or you know, say it's for the person next to me or behind me in the pew. But the for you-ness, the First Order Discourse, has its teeth, it gains traction in the body and the blood being delivered, because now it's in your mouth, and it's flesh and it's blood, and there's no confusion, there's no mistaking that this is for you. And that's why I think, or I believe, as a pastor, that First Order Discourse doesn't begin and end in the pulpit, but rather it is the lifeblood of the entire worship service, the lifeblood of liturgy, historic liturgy. Because the entirety of the liturgy, the entirety of Christian worship is ultimately direct discourse. It's proclamatory for you. You know, we do it in the beginning, in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. We confess our sins, and I say, I declare to you the entire forgiveness of all your sins. And then we conclude with the Aaronic blessing, that this is for you, that the Lord bless you and keep you, that he let his face shine on you, he favor you. So that you begin, you end, and everything in between is First Order Discourse. And therefore, the sermon is just a kind of punctuation to that.
So what you get in the radio show is the punctuation.
You get the punctuation.
With a direction to maybe if you want to hear more of this, you want the entire picture. Track them down. Send them to the churches. So check it out. It's at youareforgiven.net, actually. Youareforgiven.net. You can also listen to it if you're in the L.A. area, Orange County area, 99.5 KKLA. The times are on there. If you go to youareforgiven.net, you go to stations, you'll see the stations that it's on. Currently, it's just on one station. We hope to keep working on that and make sure it gets on more stations after that.
KKLA, the claw.
The claw. All right. On that note.
With that, yeah, back to Luther, which is what kind of frees us to do such kind of preaching.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was a radical departure from most preaching at that time, too. Not to go too far down this rabbit trail, but the very fact that Luther did not read a sermon out of a book, which was very common in those days, was to buy a book, How to Preach a Good Sermon. There were many manuals on that were just sermons. They're just devotions.
Like LutheranSermons.com?
Yeah.
Did he ever write a book of...
How to Preach?
Yeah. Because Melanchthon did. I mean,
yeah.
It is interesting.
No, not specifically Luther didn't say this is how you preach.
Huh.
Which would have been interesting, of course.
It's a side issue, but it might be enough to bring up. In the truly Reformed camp,
mm-hmm.
without getting into the third point of High Calvinism, mm-hmm. leave that aside, Mike says, or Dr. Horton says, when our guys go south, they preach about the gospel rather
Correct.
Than preaching the gospel.
Yeah, because they have nothing to declare, because they don't believe the gospel has the power to do what it says. You know, that, again, the word of the Lord goes out and he does not return empty-handed. And so for Luther to stand up in the pulpit and not just talk about Jesus or talk about the example of Jesus that we
right.
are to follow and imitate,
right.
but rather to declare you are justified for Christ's sake on account of his bloody suffering and death,
yep.
you're forgiven.
Yep.
Well, what else is there? That's it. Full stop.
Yep.
Amen. Go home.
Mm-hmm.
And that opened up a whole can of worms. Like I said, he was relieved of his responsibilities as superintendent of those monasteries at Heidelberg. Then he delivers the Heidelberg Theses, which blew everybody's mind. And then coming out of that, that's when his trouble started. You know, 1517, he posted the 95 Theses, but honestly, that was not as important or groundbreaking as we would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
1518 was. And from 1518 to 1521, a lot of what he taught, a lot of what he wrote, because of the attention he attracted after 1518, people started coming to Wittenberg. Not just students, but other monks, priests, colleagues, and more people started paying attention to the Bishop of Mainz. He's kind of like the mustache-twirling, black-hatted villain for Luther in those early days. Albrecht of Mainz, he wanted him tamped down and put under control. And so, yeah, you go through all that, and then there was the trial at Worms and the kidnapping, which wasn't really a kidnapping, but, you know, to save Luther's life, and he hid out in Coburg and became Junker Jorg, Knight George, but he blew his cover really quick because he was the only knight at the bar that was reading all the time.
That's an interesting,
George.
I mean, part of that's an interesting story that he's, some historians have argued, and I think I agree, that his success in a lot of ways has to do with his electors' willingness
yes.
to go through the motions
right.
of hiding him and for providing him the
right.
hiding place and the alternative identity.
And what was his electors' confession? He was Roman Catholic.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yes, even. I mean, Luther's confession was was Roman
yeah.
Catholic in 1521. I mean, I think you could say through 1530, these
mm-hmm.
guys are still... they're claiming to be evangelical, but they're also
right.
claiming to be part of the Roman Catholic
sure.
Church still.
Well, but I still think it's interesting that his elector protected him.
Well, and there's a history behind that even, because Frederick could have been the Holy Roman Emperor had
right.
he wanted. He was
yes.
one of the electors. Thus,
yep.
the term the elector, Frederick, is that there were seven. How many electors were there? Seven? Again, I can't remember. I have jet lag. But... he was one of the group that elected the Holy Roman Emperor.
Right, so he was eligible for the spot.
He had the money and he had the army.
Right.
He had it if he wanted it, and he didn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that Luther was able to survive, because he chose to let Luther survive, is because he had the power to say to Charles, you're not having him, and I don't know where he's at, so tough luck.
Right.
And you can't come looking for him.
Right.
And so that time in the Coburg for Luther... produce so much. And then things...
Starts translating the New Testament?
He starts translating the New Testament, starts making plans to start translating the Old Testament. He starts working on some other stuff that was on his radar. There was a lot that he was doing during that time in the Coburg Castle.
He's afflicted, too, at that point?
He's afflicted, you know, through his pot, his chamber pot at the devil.
Right.
Which, if you go to Wittenberg to this day, every year they reapply the stain to the wall for the tourists.
That's funny.
Yeah. But
I just think it's interesting that we think of him as such a sort of strong and robust character, which he was, but he was vexed by some of this.
I think his personality was very strong. You know, Melanchthon, in Melanchthon's eulogy of Luther at his funeral, he complained about, you know, early on being under the influence of Luther, the power of Luther's personality, and capitulating too often to Luther. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, what happens after 1525 and why that changed. But, no, the power of Luther's personality, the charisma, because there's only three types of reformations. There's only three types of reform movements in the history of the church. There are moral reformations, there are charismatic reformations, and there are apocalyptic reformations. And Luther is what we would call a charismatic reformer, is that the power of his personality, his skills as a teacher, as a preacher, as an orator, his ability
as a writer,
his ability to put words to paper or put words in people's ears.
And the particular time in history that allowed those words to have such diffusion.
Right. You have printing press.
Yep.
You have the diffusion of information. At one point in the 1530s, it's claimed that Luther had like 93% of everything that was in publication in Europe was Luther.
Yeah, Pettigrew argues that in Brand Luther.
Because there is no copyright law. And so everybody was paying the messenger to open that scroll and copy. Mm. It's, you know, in 1525, when Luther's debating with Erasmus, most of the general public knew what Erasmus had said about Luther before Luther found out what Erasmus had said, because everyone had had a crack at that letter before it got to Wittenberg.
Right. That's interesting, though, too. You bring up, I don't want to get too deep into Erasmus, but you're bringing up the different types of reform, moral reform, charismatic reform.
Apocalyptic.
I mean, Erasmus was considered a reformer.
He was. And early on, he and Luther were considered to be cut from the same cloth.
Right, but he's a moral reformer.
Yes.
Really.
And Zwingli.
And Zwingli, right, too.
Zwingli's early idea of reform was to clean up of the cities in Switzerland.
Right.
Right, which is also, you know, Erasmus's concern with Europe on the whole.
And the papacy and everything.
He's a traveler. The papacy, the church in general, the priesthood especially.
Right.
Being a bastard himself, right?
Being a bastard himself, in many ways.
When Luther wrote that preface to Leo, one of the things he said was, I know there have been reformers before, but they've been moral, and you're going to remember my name forever, Leo, because I'm going down to the roots that caused this, and they're doctrinal.
Right. The radical gospel, going to the root. And so coming out, he came out of Coburg because of things that were happening in Wittenberg, and the quote-unquote Reformation had got out of control because some of Luther's colleagues, Karlstadt, for one, decided that we can do things like destroy statuary and destroy anything that's Roman Catholic, essentially. And again, Karlstadt is definitely one of the proto-Protestant reformers at that time. And so Luther comes out because he's frustrated with the way, you know, Melanchthon's handling it, in his opinion.
Yeah, and at all of 24 years old.
Right, exactly. and he's frustrated.
Maybe cut him a break on that one.
And then there were the Heavenly Prophets. They were kind of what we would call big tent revival preachers, so to speak.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, the indulgence salesmen. Yeah, the Zwickau prophets. You know, when the indulgence salesmen went around, they were like a big tent revival for the sale of indulgences. And then the Heavenly Prophets come in, the Zwickau Prophets come in, in a similar situation.
And just for the sake of our listeners, those are just charismatics.
Yeah, they're just, it's fire and brimstone, repent or burn in hell forever kind of.
Cornerstone preacher.
Yeah. So Luther comes back and preaches some of the best sermons you could ever read. They're fantastic. Over 8 days, he preaches 8 sermons, and to this day, they stand up. They're brilliant. And in many ways, I think those sermons not only formed the foundation for what was going to come over the next decade as far as the Reformation, but I think it also formed the foundation of a lot of what came later in the catechisms. He was already thinking about it at that time. So you come out of 1521, he's coming out of like the Isaiah lectures, he's lecturing on Ecclesiastes, and he starts lecturing on Genesis in 1521, 1522.
Really, that early?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very interesting to me because, you know, the center of my dissertation was the bondage of the will. And
studying with Jim and Purdy, that's shocking.
Yeah, I know, yeah. And what was Luther teaching when he wrote The Bondage of the Will? He's coming out of Isaiah, Ecclesiastes, and Genesis.
Right.
And then writes The Bondage of the Will.
Yeah.
And by the way, none of those things have been translated.
Right.
Which is very telling, I think. I would love to get my hands on the Genesis lectures from the early 1520s.
Interesting.
So he comes out of that, and he's back in Wittenberg. He's teaching. The Reformation's going full bore. You know, he's excommunicated, and the bull of excommunication comes in 1521. He burns it along with, you know, the papal encyclicals, and basically says, all right, well, they excommunicated me, so, you know, we don't have to pretend anymore. We don't have to play politics. And I guess we're in it, you know, 100%. And so really in 1521, 1522, that's when things kick. As far as like a broader reformation. It's not just an academic dispute or a debate. It's not just...
Well, the preaching really begins in force too, right?
Yeah.
The
Reformation
preaching.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
Because again, his colleagues have caught it.
As does the writing.
As does
publishing.
The publishing. And then his students now are going out for
1521 too, just to, for a touch base, you have Melanchthon publishing the first edition of the Loci, which goes crazy. At that point, starts to be used in universities to train pastors.
Right. It's the second best book after the scriptures,
right,
according to Luther. It's the best, you know. So all of that is happening in that very narrow time frame of 1518 to 1521. It's a lot in just three or 4 years. And at a time when, like I said, there's no internet, there's no smartphones, there's no satellite technology, but it's spreading like wildfire because people's consciences are being unburdened.
I've become convinced that when you say there's no internet, all that means is it took more work for several people to burn the lubricantia through the night, the lamp oil through the night to get it done instead of somebody in their underwear in their basement
Googling it
online. Yeah. But the information was still being diffused. It was still being put out. It was still, there was lots of it.
Well, talk about hard work. It took him 10 years to complete his translation of the Old Testament, and then he started editing it.
Right.
Because he wasn't satisfied with it.
Right.
He was tweaking that
that could be a whole episode.
Oh, that's amazing. But so the New Testament, he's publishing the New Testament in German so people can read it. He's published, you know, he's working on the Old Testament. And for those who don't know, Luther essentially invents the modern German language in his translation of the Bible at that time because
he's got to choose a path.
He's going to the butcher and asking the butcher, what is this?
Yeah.
What's the word for a cow's liver in German? So, because I'm translating Leviticus, I got to know what this means in German so that
he's
people...
He's also choosing a grammatical path.
He's essentially determining German language, German culture, theology, society even. You know, we forget that the Germans invented childhood. There was no such thing as childhood as we understand it until
the
Reformation.
Really? It came out of Germany?
Yes. They invented childhood.
Holy smokes.
They invented...
Well, they invented the idea
of
a time period called childhood. There were probably still children.
They were children. They just had to work.
Yeah.
But it wasn't fun and games.
Right. But the whole purpose of children's education, children's toys, they invented children's books, grammars for children, parochial school, all of that, kindergarten.
And even the catechism plays into
The catechism plays into that. All of that is coming out in the 1520s.
Oh my gosh.
And his work, you know, without jumping down a little while as well. So 1523, 24, all this is happening. And then all of a sudden, all these nuns escape a convent.
And then his production slows down.
And then in 1525, the apocalypse happened. This is a true story. So all of these nuns come down the river, so to speak, and they don't know what to do with them. And so they marry them off to faculty members and others. And there's one holdout, that's Katie von Bora. And
tries to marry off three different times with three different people.
Three different people. And she's like, nope, you. And Luther's like, nope, not me. And all Luther's colleagues.
I've heard he didn't find her particularly attractive.
Well, not the paintings of her are not complimentary. She was a sturdy woman.
She was a sturdy stock.
And so in the end, he does. But here's the thing. Melanchthon, Bugenhagen, Almsdorf, I think, too.
They're all mad at him.
They're all mad. They're like, you can't get married. It'll destroy the Reformation if you get married. And here's the reason why. There was a late medieval legend, myth, that said that the Antichrist would be born of an apostate monk and a runaway nun.
Oh.
No, it's true.
My gosh.
And so when their first child was born, they had to have witnesses check for a tail.
God.
Because the Antichrist would have a pig's tail.
First child, Hans?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or was it Hans or Peter?
I don't know.
No, it was Hans.
I was asking you.
No, Hans. Because Hans apostatized.
Yes.
It was Hans.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go, kids. No matter...
named after his father.
No matter how great your father is as a preacher or teacher, there's no guarantee that his children will remain within the faith.
Right. Sometimes it works against you.
It does when your father disappears for days and days on end, and your table is never your own.
Right.
Because there's always visitors and students living with you, but...
And you live in a former cloister. The house
That was given. That was given. So the monastery is dissolved, and you have this cloister, the Black Cloister, and it was given to Luther as a gift. So he lived there, and it was big. So he had a printing press in the basement, which was convenient. And his printer lived with him in his house. So at any hour of the day or night, if Luther needed stuff printed, he just woke him up and went to the basement. His students lived there.
Until he fired him because of the quality of his work.
That's right.
Oh, gosh.
Students lived there. Visitors stayed there. It was a constant motion.
That's interesting. We should put in the show notes. I asked Donovan if he read it today, and Donovan said he doesn't read, which is obviously not true based on this interview. Rand Luther.
Andrew add Pettigrew. To the show notes. It's been in past episodes, but
there's also I cannot recall the name of the author, but CPH put out a book in their little green series of books called Luther as Translator.
Yes, it's one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll find that too. I don't recall the author's name, and it's not. But
was it Pelican? Pelican wrote a.
Yeah, but that wasn't it.
But it's a different book than the Pelican conclusion. Yeah.
But it really does tell the story quite well of the Luther's process of translating, why it takes so long.
Yeah.
It takes so long. It means it's quite good. So lots of things in show notes. Hey, Donovan, we need to close up. This is the nature of our show, and it drives us crazy, but we love it.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have you sort of recommend some reads for our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't put Kittleson on there, I might throw my pipe at you.
Okay.
Well, not that one. It's too nice.
That's a nice pipe.
Yeah.
Okay, my lighter?
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
For those who want a basic, very useful, very well-done introduction to Luther, Kittleson's book is the best, Luther the Reformer. And then after you read that, if you want to dig deeper, Heiko Obermann, Luther, God Between, or God, yeah, Luther.
Man
Between God and the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of some more recent ones. Those are my two go-to biographies that I really enjoy.
Those are the two I go to.
And then there's some, there's older stuff, like Bulmer's biography of Luther.
Sure, you could, Here I Stand, right?
Here I Stand.
Baiton,
yeah.
It's not, people these days, I think snotty historians will...
Yeah.
Kind of rail against it, but
Alistair McGrath wrote a book, Luther's Theology of the Cross.
Sure did, yeah.
Yes. Was a nice introduction
from
a non-Lutheran. Gordon Rupp did a lot of great work with Luther. He was not a Lutheran. This is the thing too:
how is it those British evangelicals him?
They have objectivity.
Gosh,
they're not. They're not kind of incestuously
over
linked
and
to
over and over.
McGrath is good.
McGrath's solid. Rupp's book, The Righteousness of God, our essays on Luther. That's a good old book. If you can look at, find it on eBay or whatever. But yeah, start with Kittleson. Move on to Obermann. Those are the two solid, texts for learning more about Luther.
And I'll say, listeners, don't despair. Donovan will not be our last interview on Luther.
That's right.
We'll make a note that we stopped just before the publication of the Catechisms and just before the publication of the Bondage of the Will.
Yeah, thanks for robbing me of that.
Well, we'll probably give that one to Ness again.
He's old. He's retired. He doesn't think well anymore.
He's irrelevant.
He's not dependable at all.
God,
not at all.
Oh,
Nestigan said that I was like the son that he
couldn't wait
for him to leave home.
Yeah.
Oh, Donovan was like a son to me.
I won't tell you.
I couldn't wait to.
I wouldn't tell you what he says about me. Kind of the opposite.
Oh.
But it was great. Loved having you on the show.
Well, thank you. It was great.
If it weren't dinner time, we'd probably have you on for two more just tonight. But me and food. So
yeah, we got to get that food.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, listeners. Remember to subscribe and rate the show. Help us out. Help you out.
Share it on all of your different
Facebook
pages,
Twitter, things like that.
Twitter it.
And don't forget, you can always send us questions you have about episodes or other things. We just got some listeners contact us today, and that's always fantastic. So we have a contact us at thethinkingfellows.com website, and we'd love to hear from you.
All right.
Catch you next time.